In every human being, there is only so large a supply of love. It's like the limbs of a starfish to some extent. If you chew off a chunk, it'll grow back. But if you chew off too much, the starfish dies. Valerie B. chewed off a chunk of love from my dwindling reserve, a reserve already nibbled by Charlotte and Lori and Sherry and Cindy and others down through the years. There's still enough to make a saleable appearance of a whole creature, but nobody gets gnawed on that way without becoming a little dead. So if Cupid, that perverted little motherfucker, decides his lightning ought to strike this gnarly tree trunk again, whomever or whatever gets me is going to get a handy second. Damaged goods, something a little dead and a little crippled. Having learned that, all I can advise is an impossible stance for all of you. Utter openness and reasonable caution. Don't close yourself off, but Jesus, be careful of monsters with teeth. I just hope you'll know what they look like when they come clanking after you.
There was just bizarre, wonderful audio comedy. It's the audible equivalent of a Hieronymus Bosch painting. And you're always looking for the little guy in the back with the three legs coming out of the ass of a chicken. That's what was, for me, kind of interesting. That's why I went, I'm in! And later on, when you got into the more interesting levels, they really started to talk to me. But then you realize that some of the, well, all of the albums connect. And then I was like going, oh.
Yes or no, true or false? Yes or no, and you can qualify them if you want.
Okay.
This will be not used against you.
You're not in a court of law.
No, we've done that already.
Okay.
Okay, ready?
Yeah.
First one. Mail dead gopher to publishing house.
Absolutely true. And it went during the summer, and it went by fourth class mail.
So you want to make sure it was there and a little bloated, but...
Cost them thousands to fumigate.
Attacked ABC executive breaking pelvis.
True, absolutely true. Voyage to the bottom of the sea. I went for him, climbed up onto the conference table in Irwin Allen's office. There was a lot of papers on the desk. It was highly polished. I slipped, very heroic of me, and face first went into him like that and caught him in the throat with the fist. He went over backwards and hit the wall, and there was a 6-foot-long model, or 18-foot-long model, of the Sea View on the wall, and it broke loose from its moorings and fell on him and broke his pelvis.
As this memorable broadcast from the Pissgarten Olympic Auditorium in Hochstaffel, Bavaria, a blistering day in August 1932. 23. The exciting scene of the first famous sports broadcast, the Schmeling Herring Fist Fest.
I'm in the back of this great big auditorium where these great big white man and great big black man are training a tremendous series of great big punches. Oh, and Herring's down in the sauce. The white man is down, and the German is up, and they're raining terrific blows on the black man. Now they're pummeling the gypsies and the Jews. Oh, band of brothers! And here comes the Spanish air farce. Oh, it looks like a rehearsal for the final solution. Oh, those Spanish flyboys are so sexy. Schmeling is circling, but now the referee, a feisty little fellow with a funny-looking mustache, he's stopping the fight. He's raising his right arm in a stiff salute for silence. Oh. Everyone in the hall is doing the duck. I mean, doing the same. I think they're all asking to leave the room. So it appears from Bissgarten Hall that round one goes to the Jerrys.
Man, was that exciting.
When I was a kid, I was beaten up every day. Probably I was beaten up because I had a big mouth. I don't deny it, but you still don't deserve to have the crap beaten out of you every day just because you're a smartass. But in those days, I was a little kid. God, I think I'd have been soaking drenched wet to weigh 50 pounds. And it was a very anti-Semitic town, Painesville, about 30 miles northeast of Cleveland. And they would
they would wait for me on the schoolyard. They would pound me every day. And while I could, when I was the same size, I held my own okay. But they kept growing. I kept staying small. And groups of them would beat the crap out of me. And when you've been made an outsider, you are always angry. You respond to it in a lot of different ways. A lot of people get surly. A lot of people get mean. Some people turn into serial killers. I got so smart that I could just kill them with logic or their own mouths.
Sometimes I had to use my head rather than my fists. I remember running into some tough kids on the way home from Allen Stevenson. They made fun of my school uniform and my book bag and clearly were ready to use me as a punching bag. But before they could throw the first blow, I imitated their Upper East Side accents. "Can you believe this shit?" I drawled, extending my vowels like they did. "You guys are lucky. You don't have to study all this crap," I went on, sounding like one of them. And they were too surprised to hit me. Quickly, I offered, "See ya," as nonchalantly as I could, and got the hell out of there. And it could be dangerous at school, too, because in our tap dancing class, there was a gym teacher who loved to kick kids in the ass. I don't mean he would harass us to motivate us. I mean, his foot made a harsh impact on many highly challenged young behinds for fun. My longtime pal, photographer and musician Rob Lewin, now married to Phyllis Katz of the renowned Groundlings comedy troupe, was one of those who witnessed bad behavior by these bullies.
But there's a photograph we got upstairs here of my third grade class, and I'm the shortest kid in the class. I'm shorter than the smallest girl. And everybody else is standing like a normal kid. I'm standing there at the far end on the left, like this, with my hands on my hips, and I'm leaning forward, and my lips are skinned back like some feral creature, and I'm wearing my Captain Midnight Secret Decoder badge, and there's a Band-Aid on my forehead. And way down at the other end is Bill Brown, and Bill Brown's got an even bigger bandage on his face because I had been in a fist fight with him earlier in the day. Jack Wheeldon, Teddy Beckwith. They were the bullies to me. I have no idea what they were like in the rest of their lives. They may have been terrific kids. But they used to like to beat me up regularly. And one time they caught me on the playground my mind likes to say in the dead of winter and, you know, a great deal of snow. But it was just, I think it was in the fall. It was cold, but it wasn't that cold. And they beat the shit out of me. And I was obviously not dead. I was obviously not seriously injured, but I was bloody and I was torn apart. And my mother took me upstairs to wash me off, get me squared away. And I tried to explain to her what had happened. And when you're that age, you cannot explain to an adult the irrational. Everything has to have a progression, an interior logic. And there is no interior logic to bullies picking on someone. Why you? Well, why in fact not me? And my mother said, and I remember this as if it were yesterday, my mother with a washcloth in her hand and me standing at the sink, she said, "You must have said something to get them angry." And it was an icicle just jammed into my chest that my own mother, and with cause, it was not as if I was the greatest kid in the world. I was a troublemaker. I was a brat. I was a big mouth pain in the ass. But that my own mother would not understand it. At that moment, I had what now at age 72, I understand was an enormous epiphany, which is, I really cannot support it. I cannot bear it when people laugh at me.
I don't know if my mom ever told me jokes, but she helped me write comic poetry. And the first line that I ever remember writing with my mom that was funny, I had to write it for library, was, "A boy and a kite on each end of a string is surely a sign that it soon will be spring."
Oh, that's very sweet.
Isn't that sweet? My mom would write this kind. And I was a big star in library. That was my big time in elementary school when I could read my
poems. Was that like stand and deliver? You know, I mean,
yeah,
you stand up and
stand
say,
up and deliver it. Every, you know, and I was really happy about doing it. I felt really good. I feel very much the same way, just like talking on the radio now.
Here I am, maybe 86 pounds dripping wet and carrying an anvil. And I'm in with the Rangers in a barracks full of guys who were offered the opportunity of either going in the army or being thrown in prison for the rest of their lives. The only reason they didn't kill me was, you know, we'd come back from a 20-mile march, full pack. In those days, we carried an M1. None of this little pushy AK-47 crap, you know, made of plastic. We had an M1, which weighed 900 pounds, and the full pack. And I never fell out. I was a mean little dog. I just wouldn't go down. We'd come back, and everybody would just fall face forward on their bunk with the pack still on. I would take out from under my mattress a board that I had secreted there and take my typewriter out of the wall locker, and I would go into the toilet and take the furthest toilet in the line so nobody would hear me, and I put the board across my lap and I would work on my novel after everybody was exhausted and dead, and I was still, and that's how I did my book. Well, they call me the author. Hey author. And I've always been pretty good at figuring out systems and how they work and finding ways around them. So now here's the parameters of my problem. I'm small. I'm surrounded by bullies. I'm in a system that has me in its thrall from the moment I wake up till the moment I go to sleep at night. And I've got to protect myself from being brutalized. How do I do it? Real simple. Most of the people in the barracks were illiterate, and I volunteered to write the letters home to their girlfriends. I became their Cyrano. Anybody came near me, or if I got extra duty, they would take it. They would do it for me.
This has been a great show. Your Army Reserve Federal Social Security Review with Marine Private Vaughn Filkins.
Hey,
here.
Vaughn. It's been great.
Spinning the platters and... I can't keep that up for very long.
You can't.
You know, I used to do Army Reserve radio programs. Did I ever talk about this on the air before?
I don't know. Does it make any difference?
Bear my horrible soul to the... I used to do a show on KIEV Sunday mornings.
Kiev.
Kiev Radio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. With Yuri Gagarin.
It was a country and western radio show.
Did you ever
hear my show?
Kiev.
Marine Private Vaughn Filkins. You never heard... It was called something like Country and Western... Country and... Your Army Reserve Country and Western Show or something like that. It was something really kind of inspired like that. And we played Ferlin Husky, and this old sergeant I had in the Army named Sergeant Louis Illuminato, who was indeed an enlightened man, as far as I've been able to determine. He was like a Zen monk, man. The cat was just incredible. He was so spaced. And he was my sergeant, and he thought that I was his son. My hair kept getting longer and longer, and I kept getting in more and more trouble with the Army. But Sergeant Louis Illuminato still considered me basically his son. It never made any difference to him what I did. He liked me because I did the country and western show.
That's a good reason to like somebody.
That was the whole story of my Army career. I was crazier than hell, man. But those old crazy drunken Army sergeants, I always got along really good with those guys.
Sergeant Imperial.
Sergeant Imperial. Peter had a good one. Yeah.
Mine was Sergeant Imperial. That's right, Sergeant Imperial was a Cancer. No, he was a Leo, man. And he knew that everybody called him Frog. And he lived off of that fact. And everybody called him Frog became part of that thing. You know, they'd sit there and they'd go, here comes the Frog. Grib it. And he'd get out there and look like a frog. The man really did look like a frog. Bless him.
You know, we're the last generation, man. Maybe you and I, at least specifically, to be in the Army, basically. Yeah. It is our job to pass on information of a body or useful nature to people who'll never have to go through what we did. Because, like, I certainly hope that no young man in this day and age is going in, for God's sake. I mean, certainly I would hope you're not doing it.
You don't have to. You know.
No, you don't have to do it, man. And we'll tell you about it. If you feel that there's anything that you may be missing... We're perfectly available at any time to sit around and tell you gory old Army stories, but there's no need to do it yourself.
Secret number one, it's not going to be public, which is you don't have to cut your hair. All reservists, attention, all reservists, beep, 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 driving home from hell. This is Sunday, right?
Oh, this is
You don't have to cut your hair.
Yeah,
no
you guys,
further.
See, let me tell them about Catch 23, man.
Yeah.
The Army, if you do something weird, like letting your hair grow, which Bergman and I both did, which got us out, because... then they think that you're crazy because you don't want to cut off all your hair and stand around in straight lines. They won't really do anything bad to you, but all you've got to do is convince them that you really don't agree with them. They call that crazy. And
being yourself.
Being weird, right. And it will either get you special privileges for being crazy. Like when I went to summer camp once, they wouldn't let me pull KP. They wouldn't let me do it because my hair was too long.
Right.
And it was dirty,
you see.
Gets
caught in the drains.
You get into interesting situations like that and cause a lot of ruckus and feel somehow as if you're doing something for the revolution. Or carry a little farther and you just get out. They just let you out eventually saying, oh, well, because they don't really want you, man. And they especially wouldn't want you if you started acting weird.
I don't mean to foment revolution or anything like that.
We've got 537 overstrength by 5% men in this unit, and Mr. Bergman, this army has never lost a war, and it's not going to lose a war to you.
Well, the ground rules for me now make it almost impossible for me to be hired. I ain't going to go through it anymore. I'm just not going to go through it. Producers, studios, production companies, no matter... They probably don't beat their children. They wouldn't think of running over a dog. They treat writers like chattel. And we are absolutely dispensable once they have gotten what they want out of us, which is a script. Until they get the script, man, they just are the most sycophantic brown nosers you've ever seen. Once they get those pages in their hands, you could be hit by a Peterbilt and they wouldn't give a fuck. So... And then they feel it's theirs. They can do whatever they want. And here comes a director a year later and says, well, I see it this way, and I see this, and I see that. Fuck you. You want to get your vision? You write the goddamn script. Where were you when the page was blank?
Yeah, he's like a skin graft on a leper, you know. He's always there trying to bring quality, you know. He's always been about that when he wrote, like, The Glass Teep. It was a great criticism of the death of television and the transformation of television into a medium versus... media, something that can transform versus something that's just to conform.
There are people who would sit and watch them drag books out of libraries and burn them in piles in the streets. They would stand and watch old ladies mugged to death by street gangs, and they would not lift a finger. But if you were to take their TV away from them, they would be on the steps of City Hall with pitchforks and pump shotguns in 5 minutes. That is because nobody likes their dope taken away from them. And that's what TV is. It's dope.
We went up to Fresno last weekend. We stopped in a couple of roadside places, and all of them had the TV set on. Nobody watching, but the goddamn TV set going. And when you say, would you mind turning off the TV? They say, why? Because it's making noise, and it's disturbing me, and there's no one else in the restaurant, and I'm your customer. Can you handle that? And they look at you as if you have just said their grandmother was butt-fucked by Adolf Hitler. You know, they simply feel imposed upon if you remove that giant tit from their mouth. Well, people are stupid because they've got the handmaiden of television.
The only truth you know is what you get over this tube. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube is the gospel, the ultimate revelation. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. This tube is the most awesome force in the whole godless world.
You know, I love the radio, and I have to say, I don't want to be too down on this, but I love the radio, and I hate the TV. And why do I hate the TV? Because the pictures are better on radio. You know, in a world where Henry Kissinger can get the Nobel Peace Prize, and the country can mourn Richard Nixon as great president, anything is possible. What has brought us to this state? Well, if you flip on the TV and peruse the pigeon-breasted, pulpit-pounding sideshow salesmen that pass themselves off quite successfully as the press secretaries for God, then you will believe that since 1945, we have suffered at the hands of the commies, the liberals, the dope smokers, the junkies, the homosexuals, and the lesbians. Not necessarily in that order. Now, here's the trick. The real foe, baby, is right before you, not the preacher. Necessarily, but the idiot box that presents him and thousands of other false prophets simultaneously on 1,000 other channels. My favorite channel, you know, by the way, is the Amish Shopping Channel. We get it here in L.A. I don't know if it's gotten out to the wasteland yet. Now, look, that snake with the one eye, which is what I call my TV, that daily robs my imagination, has become the default teacher, the default friend, and the default parent, the babysitter that sits on more than the baby. It sits on our culture and shuts down our will to be free. Our will to be free. Now, here's the idea. Turn off the snake. Take the rattle out of the prattle box and let us run free. Oh, it'll be difficult. The propaganda has been steady and manufactured by the best in the business. But we can overcome. As the Russians threw off their oppressive system when it was finally revealed that it was nothing but hollowness and impotency, so we in America can end the mediocrity and take our future into our own hands. Now, it's going to require a change in attitude, a change in lifestyle, and a change in morals. The medium of television, except in very small doses, is pernicious to our precious imagination. But commercial television is far more deadly. It is the demon that is eating us alive. So don't listen to the smooth voices of the paid apologists. Test it out for yourself. If you have the courage, turn off your TV for a week and deal with the hole in your life. You'll be bored. You'll twitch like a junkie laying on a lonely bed going cold turkey. You'll feel empty, and the quiet around you will seem strange beyond belief. But take heart. Your precious mind will save you if you give it half a chance. Exercise. Sweat out all the false messages in you. Sweat out the lies, the cleverly tooled half-truths have been given you free in exchange for your freedom. 1 week, that's all it takes. The snake with one eye will never look the same after that. Then after you've seen through the trick by not looking at it, you're ready to take action against the forces that hold you in thrall. Boycott the bastards. Let the world know that you've put your TV in the closet, or smashed it with a Louisville slugger, or converted it into a planter. Revolution has always been a personal thing. You are the masses. You have been targeted one at a time, and you must resist as an individual, not as a demographic or a number on a chart or an address on a mailing list. One act of resistance at a time, and watch the tower of the cell sorcerers tumble. Free. Free at last.
Television is not like movies. Television is not like books. Television is not like anything but television. It gives you everything. I mean, I think it's ironic that you're probably, whoever ever sees this, will be seeing it on a TV screen. I doubt that they'll be seeing it on a big movie screen. And maybe it'll be a cassette, but they'll be watching it on a TV screen. It gives you that. It's not like radio. Radio is wonderful. Radio, you create it in your mind and you can see it. You can make it just as colorful and as smart and as opulent as you wish it to be.
What is it?
It's radio movies.
It's radio movies!
Good evening. Now watch your step, please.
This way to the radio movie soundstage.
Oh, nice to have you with us. Right this way.
Popcorn, popcorn. Get your nice friend.
Hello, and welcome to the radio movie soundstage. I'm David Osmond, and this week our feature is one of the great British high-style comedies, Private Lives by Noel Coward, in a glistening black-and-white production from the BBC. All right, George, we're ready. Yes, here's Act One of Private Lives.
On television, that's it. That's what you get, and that's the whole thing. This means you don't have to work for it. You can sit there like the couch potato, and that's it. You got to have a good thumb, and that's about it. That's one reason people are stupid. They just are not using their brains. You don't use a muscle, it atrophies. Susan, my wife and I, one night we were going somewhere. We were channel surfing. We were going somewhere. I don't know where it was. And we wound up, for some inexplicable reason, we paused. I don't know why. We paused, and we're watching The Weakest Link. Now, if this is in fact turned into a film, and 20 years from now someone's looking at it, they'll say, what was The Weakest Link? Weakest Link is a television show in which they have people who are brought in as contestants. I think they are tested on their DNA, and if their intellectual level falls below 7 or that of an Othello sponge mop, they become a contestant. If you actually know anything, you cannot possibly win a dime on this goddamn show because you are surrounded by people who have the intellectual level of a marmoset. So one of the people who was allowed, I mean, she weathered the first couple of rounds, I guess, and here she was standing there, and she was a very well turned out young woman, about
25, I would say. And the question that was asked of her was this. What S, who was a star of Lawrence of Arabia, wrote a long-running, award-winning bridge column? Well, okay, it's not a terribly obscure piece of information. I know some of you know it, I know you know it. But even if you don't know that it was Omar Sharif, her answer was Naomi Campbell. Now, this is wrong in so many ways that Susan and I sat there with a hypertension buzz running through our head as if we had stuck our hand into a generator. A, there's no S in Naomi Campbell. B or two, whichever I started with, Naomi Campbell wasn't even born when Lawrence of Arabia was made. Three, Naomi Campbell is a supermodel who could barely write her name. She may be the nicest person in the world. She wouldn't bite the head off a chicken. But Naomi Campbell has never written a column or anything else. And this answer was so stupid, was so wrong, was so illiterate, so culturally devoid of any resonance at all, that around this house, it now became the answer to every question. What was the name of the ship that struck an iceberg in the North Atlantic and sank? The Naomi Campbell. Who was it who discovered radium? Naomi Campbell. Name the third president of the United States. Naomi Campbell. Naomi Campbell is now the answer in our household. Whenever we want to sound like an absolute gibbering orangutan, we use Naomi Campbell.
Welcome back to Good Nights. We're just chatting here with Naomi Hungry, Heroin Perfume's spokesmodel.
That's super spokesmodel. Heroin said they wanted me for 3 years, but that was just big.
Sorry, Naomi, this is network television. You can't say that on TV.
That's BF.
That's better.
Would you like to settle this war right now?
Yeah,
I mean, okay. Let's look between two idiots. Look, you're an idiot and I'm an idiot.
Okay,
we both know
but
that.
I'm the head idiot of my country.
Okay, you can be the head idiot of your country if I can be the head idiot of my country.
I'll grant you
what
that.
What about all those little countries in between?
Those two dumb guys.
Okay, what did you say?
Well, what about all these little countries in
those
between?
Those little countries, look at them. They're full of idiots.
Those guys
they're full of idiots just like us.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Hey, you here. Little idiots, any of you idiots over there want to come over here with us idiots and solve this war?
We're the heads of the pin trust over here.
We're not smart enough to understand about that kind of
stuff.
We're
the dummies.
We're the dummies.
I'm the dumbest guy in my country.
That's true.
And you're the dumbest guy in your country.
I'll come and live in your country. Then I won't have to be the dumbest guy anymore.
I'll go over to your country, too. It'll be great. Those Moscow girls really knock me out.
Golly.
They leave the West behind.
All right, so we're at MIT.
Okay, we're at MIT. We're in the question and answer bit. We've all done a little talk. We're now at the giant Q&A bit. A kid comes up. I don't even remember what he said, but it was stupid. And it was ignorant.
Yeah.
And you lost it with him. In a way that I would never have lost it with him, or that Peter David would never have lost it. And it was a question directed at you.
Yeah.
And you lost it. And the kid, instead of being upset or anything, it was like the Bible. It was strangely biblical because the kid basically said, "You gave him the you are ignorant, you know nothing rant," and he basically said, "Yes, master, I am ignorant."
I'm concerned that you seem to like to offend or shock people, which is okay, but. It seems that you have wisdom that you'd like to share with most of us, being dumb as posts and
I get the question.
With trying to be irreverent.
I got the question.
You see where I'm going?
No, I see where you went, and I can answer the question perfectly. Okay. Now, put the microphone back in its stand, and I'll give you the answer.
It would be my pleasure.
Good. Okay, first of all, give me an honest, straight answer for yourself. Do you think you are dumb as a post? Shut the fuck up. I'm serious. Do you think you're dumb as a post?
Yes.
Okay, why do you think that of yourself? The fact that you ask the question means you are not dumb as a post.
No matter what his position was, he knew what he felt and what he wanted to say, and he was going to be damned if he was going to be run off that stage by a bunch of yahoos in this audience. And that image really stuck with me and really made an impression on me about what it meant to write something, to stand behind it, to believe in it, and to not care if you were the only one in the room that believed that. You still stood by the work.
As Kafka said, art is like a brick that should be thrown through a window. If it does not break the ice that lives within you, why bother to do it? So if I seem to you to be offensive, so be it.
There was a fellow who just recently broke the brick-breaking record with his hand.
But that was me.
Yeah, Larry is the guy with the big hand over the vanity shop. They had to stop you after 2,600 bricks.
127 times. Yeah. I forgot because I was using my head there toward the end.
Right,
you
were doing it to raise money for a charitable cause, however, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. That's right.
What was the cause? Could
the
you come
idiot,
up
for the Idiots Fund?
The Idiots Fund.
The Idiots Fund.
I see.
I'm not an idiot myself.
And, talk to us here.
Let me through the door.
Come on.
Get the door, please.
Only get to use that door once or twice per show, you know.
You've got a garbage can on your foot.
Oh, yeah. That's a garbage masher.
Oh, there.
There we go. I used that to mash up the garbage, you know.
Good. How many bricks can a brick breaker break when a brick breaker breaks a few bricks, yes?
Boy, that's a brick. Well, a fella like myself, you know. I prefer to take the bricks in their natural state when they're in a building, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these kind of fag guys, they like to break them when they're out of the buildings. But
yeah.
I do it on the whole buildings. Boom, like that, and a brick breaks and a whole building comes down.
You're the guy who was responsible for breaking the bank just last week, aren't you?
Yeah, that's me.
Is that the one at Monte Carlo?
Hmm? No, that's my name.
Oh.
Monte Carlo.
Monte Carlo. You do this act, then?
Yeah.
You're involved?
I'm not acting, no.
No?
No, this is real.
Oh.
It was a chemical pig exchange bank, I believe it was.
Mm. Monty, I wonder if you could answer a question here for me, since you're an expert on this.
Okay.
Monty.
Prof.
What do you guys call or think about a guy who's a strike-breaking, a brick-breaking strike?
We would think that he had struck out, certainly, in the eyes of his fellow workers.
Workers,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Want to reveal to you they're my working-class background.
Yes, right.
I think you're leaking.
Oh.
Could you stand over there in the next to that bucket?
Here. Yeah.
Good. Carol, that's better.
Keep him off mic for a while, would you? It's like keeping him
Where's
off speed.
Mike?
Yeah.
Mike, I'm going to get you.
Yeah, he's leaking over there. That's all right. Just don't let him.
I got out here in 62 with exactly 10 cents in my pocket. It's one of those great Horatio Alger up from the streets kind of stories. And I knew maybe three people in the whole town. I came out with these horrible visions of William Holden lying face down in Gloria Swanson's swimming pool, and I told everybody I'll be back in 6 months. And I kept going back to New York, but as time went on, I began to perceive the differences between New York and L.A., and they were manifest.
Los Angeles is the cutting edge of the culture. Despite the claims and pretensions of San Francisco and New York and Boston and Washington, it has all the verve and dynamism that I found in New York when I went there in 1950. Verve and dynamism that New York has lost, that Chicago wanted and for which it substituted brutality and angst, that New Orleans is afraid to let loose. For me, L.A. is like a big gauche baby with a shotgun in its mouth. It'll do anything, and with more style, with more fire, with more Errol Flynn go to hell vivacity than any other city I've ever experienced. I love L.A. So, and it's become a big city now, and it's just like everywhere else in America. It's in chaos. But here I live on the top of a mountain with 200 acres of watershed land behind me. If you just look past me here, that's the San Bernardino Mountains, what we call the San Berdus, and that's the San Fernando Valley. And that's about 40 miles over there. And I'll go to some place like Coshocton, Ohio, or East Weewa, you know, Wisconsin, and some smartass will say, how can you live in Los Angeles with all that smog? And I just kind of giggle, because I say, I don't see any smog. The only smog there is down there is down in the valley killing Republicans. I don't give a shit about that.
It's been very clear in Los Angeles, so you get a chance to see it. And so I've gotten a wonderful perspective from my Zeppelin, just looking down at the town and everything like that. Good chance to see the old Earth. Because when the smog moves back in, you see, the feeling I have, what's going to happen is that the smog will move in during the summer, and one fall, it'll get blown away by the big winds, and there'll be a different thing there. An entirely different thing, right? A new city, right?
Or the smog has its own alchemy. It'll change it.
That's right.
It'll just change it.
I understand that if the smog and the heat are combined just right, it'll cook the whole city.
Really?
Yeah, that's
Well, that'll be
say.
Tasty eating, Bob, for us trolls.
Yum, yum.
Stop paying trolls.
The hills. The whole
We come out from under the freeway. Bridget's where we live.
Hey, trolls. The whole place will be spinning like a great Colonel Palmer sign, whatever is the name of those people.
Colonel Human.
Colonel Human.
You know, people say to me, even Susan says to me, "My God, does everything make you angry?" I say, "Yeah, everything makes me angry." And they say, "Well, you know, you should be a little mellow, get a little mellow." And I say, "Oh, really? Gee, I had never thought of that. Get a little mellow. Woo, what an epiphany. Like, I enjoy this? You think I enjoy getting up angry every morning, going to bed angry every night, to go through the day with the veins standing out, the bolts unscrewing in my neck? Jesus Christ, I would give anything to be able to be as mellow and cool as most people. I'd be, one of the slaves, and, you know, the Walking Dead, but it would be a relief. Give me 6 months as a Walking Dead, and I'll never say anything angry again."
Oh, wow. Look at the stars, man. Wow, the stars, there's so many of them.
That's hot, man.
Really?
For sure. Whatever. Oh, wow.
Wow, yeah.
Hey, guy. How's the divorce?
Oh, great. We divided our kids between our two lawyers.
Oh, wow, you got Solomon and Solomon, huh? Yeah, they divided our kid, too.
That's hot.
Really?
For sure.
Whatever.
Oh, wow.
Okay, watch out, guys. Hot stuff behind you. Look at this, huh? I ought to be in porno. That's where the money is.
Here, smoke this.
Oh, no.
I'll hold it. Your hands
are grass is for hippies.
Hey, me and the girlfriend, we really got to move to a bigger house. But the bank wants it down in coke.
Money, man, it's tough. I had to pay my dentist bill with my gold fillings.
Go for it.
Right.
Oh, for sure.
Whatever.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Hey.
What?
When I put the towel over my face like this, what do I look like?
Gary Gilmore.
No, one of the hostages.
Ooh. Oh, that's heavy.
Yeah, who isn't?
Yeah, for sure.
Who isn't heavy?
No, who isn't a hostage?
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Hey.
What?
Ugh, is this a hair? Hair in the hot tub? Oh, gross. Man.
Gross out.
Gross out, man.
No, man, that's... Here, you, man. That's the Siamese seaweed soap, man.
Oh.
Hey, long hair is
what?
Short hair.
What?
Hair is dead, huh?
Yeah, right. Go for it, Baldy.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Whatever.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Hey,
wow.
Hey, any of you guys think that maybe this hot tub's too hot?
Oh, ask Pam Jurgensen, man. It's her hot tub. Give me that.
Where is Pam Jurgensen?
Pam, honey.
She's around here.
Hey, look there. Down there in the Siamese seaweed.
Wow. Poached.
That's hot.
Really?
For sure.
Whatever.